and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Panier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. It's been 1 year since Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a massive invasion of Ukraine. The impact of that decision is felt globally, but is especially keen in Central Asia, a region with a long history of Russian involvement. How has Russia's war in Ukraine affected Russia's ties with Central Asia? And how has Russia's debacle in Ukraine affected the views of Central Asia's people toward their former colonizer? To discuss all this, I am joined by Erica Murat, a professor of political science at the National Defense University in Washington, and Timur Umarov, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek. And thank you both for joining me today. Erica, I'll start with you. How have some of the Central Asian governments been reacting to this over the course of the year, especially Kazakhstan, for instance?
Right. So Central Asian countries have been reacting to Russia's war in Ukraine really differently. But I think if there is one description to all five countries is that they've been cautious to openly support Russia. And we can see that from, for instance, UNGA votes, where they abstained or absent on key votes, with some exceptions. And then from time to time, also disengaging from Russian security initiatives in the region. But at the same time, I see that all Central Asian countries, and especially Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and to an extent Uzbekistan, are also, they see an opportunity to benefit from Western sanctions in Russia, and they allow transit of goods from Europe through Central Asia to Russia. That is an economic benefit to Central Asian countries, just like to South Caucasus countries as well. So politically, there has been some cautious reaction to Russia's war. Economically, I think they have been quite collaborative.
Okay, thank you. Certainly the Russia's situation and the fact that it's focused, its attention is focused pretty much on, mainly on what events in Ukraine right now. It's offered some opportunities for some other countries or other players to try to make inroads, advances in Central Asia. Timur, can you talk about some of the countries that have been much more active in Central Asia since Russia started the war in Ukraine?
Yes, thank you for having me, Bruce. I think that the most active actor in Central Asia for, the last several years and since the start of the war has been Kazakhstan. In my view, Kazakhstan was the most affected because its economy is pretty much tied with the Russian economy. It's a part of the Eurasian Economic Union. And for Kazakhstan, it was very important to, from the very beginning, to make everyone sure that Kazakhstan is not joining Russia's aggression towards Ukraine. And that is why we saw different high-ranking officials saying that they're not becoming this window for Russia for, to escape from sanctions. We saw messages sent by the President Tokayev himself. And, also we saw peoples being very supportive of Ukraine. The amount of aid that has been sent officially and unofficially from Kazakhstan is the biggest from Central Asia. President Tokayev is the only president from Central Asia who had spoken with President Volodymyr Zelensky for three times since the invasion has started. And I would say that is why, Kazakhstan has been the most loud and active. But other countries also trying, based on kind of their positioning and their opportunities that they have, to do at least enough so that the world would not include them into this basket of supporters of Russia. I mean, Uzbekistan was also in close consultative meetings with the U.S. on how to react with the sanctions, etc. And the ex-ambassador of the U.S. to Uzbekistan, Daniel Rosenblum, has been saying that in one of his interviews. But also, other countries didn't publicly say anything about the war in Ukraine. We haven't heard anything from Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. So, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Then let me follow up with this. Then, you know, there's certainly some things that Russia probably can't provide the Central Asians with immediately that Central Asians usually get from Russia, right? I'm thinking certainly military supplies, which are absolutely in doubt. And I'll let you talk about this too, Erica, in a minute. But, you know, Central Asians have been buying most of their military goods, with the exception of Turkmenistan, for years from Russia. But looking at how well that or how poorly that equipment is working in Ukraine, they've obviously had some second thoughts. Who are they reaching out to fill gaps that they see being left as Russia is unable to supply the goods or even support, moral support, that they did in the past?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, what Russia has proved with its invasion in Ukraine, that its reputation of a global superpower was for a long time overestimated, and that in reality, Russia is not such a great power as it wanted everyone to believe in. So Central Asian countries, especially those countries who relied a lot on Russia's support and security, were, in my feelings, caught by surprise, especially Tajikistan, looking at how Russia is doing in Ukraine and kind of trying to put themselves in the shoes of Ukrainians and try to imagine that if something happens, Russians wouldn't be a very reliable partner. So in this regard, I think that it brings a lot of talks about, again, recalling this multivectoral foreign policy for any Central Asian country. It brings Central Asian countries a bit closer together. But at the same time, we actually see some Central Asian states to try to use this moment of Russia's weakness to gain much more from Russia than it previously was. For example, Tajikistan, the president of Tajikistan, Emomali Rahmon, he openly said that right now he wants more attention from Russia to its country than ever before. And I wouldn't say that all Central Asian countries are trying to kind of get away from Russia, which is toxic and weak. Some are not thinking about their situation strategically, but some are doing. For example, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan have been promoting their ties with Turkey actively in 2022, and the new agreements that have been signed between these two countries and Turkey allows much more cooperation in even in very sensitive security sphere. So I would say that they're turning to new partners, which is Turkey, but also some classic partners of Central Asia, which is China.
Thank you. Erica, kind of the same topic. How does this change the Central Asians' view of their security equation? It's even regime, preserving the regimes. Russia was supposed to be the big security guarantor, and I've seen that in many articles, and I've written that in some of my own articles. They were the security guarantor of Central Asia, and now that's not looking so good. And how does it affect also, if you could say a few words about trade relations too, you'd be having to bring in new partners?
So Central Asian countries have been diversifying their security alliances for a while now, with China specifically, and that started even before the war in Ukraine. I would also add, of course, Turkey and Iran to the equation, that Turkic nations in Central Asia, so 4 out of 5, are moving closer to Turkey and buying Turkish drones, whereas Tajikistan is increasing collaboration with Iran and also buying Iranian drones. So that is a more recent development in Central Asia. And when it comes to economic cooperation, just today there was an article in Financial Times showing how somehow trade with European countries, with EU, increased by manifold in Central Asia. And that's because Central Asia serves as a transit zone for EU goods going to Russia. So cars, semiconductors, technologies and so on. So in that sense, Central Asian countries did move closer to Russia in supporting Russia's shortage of Western brands on the Russian market. And Central Asian countries are seeing economic increase. So their economies are growing because of this newfound role in the equation. And the transit of the goods in Central Asia, they take place not in the shadow economy, but within formal economy, because Russia allows parallel imports. And it's not that Central Asian countries are smuggling, or Central Asian entrepreneurs are smuggling Western goods, Western brands to Russia, but it's all done within the formal economy. Of course, there are some informalities and intermediaries that are involved now as well, but Central Asian countries are seeing economic increase because of how they are located close to Russia. And Central Asian countries, so Kazakhstan talked about preventing Western brands from passing through Kazakhstan to Russia, even within the parallel import regime in Russia. But that initiative from last summer went to nowhere. And even though formally Kazakhstan does not, so Kazakhstan supports Western sanctions. Formally, it supports Western sanctions against Russia and does not want to break them. It also, in fact, helps transit of Western brands to Russia through its territory. So it's a really, you can call it double standard, or a way of adapting to Western demands, Western expectations, and also Russia's expectations in this case.
So is this a question of the informal economy stepping up when the formal economy is taking a hit?
Well, it's hard to say that it's even informal economy when you see Western brands, and for instance, brands like Apple or Samsung or any car maker going through Kazakhstan. And because Russia allows parallel imports, so Russia allows imports of sanctioned brands to its market, Kazakhstan and other countries are not really breaking any rules by exporting stuff, you know, exporting those goods through its territory. And yes, there is informal economy that is growing as well, but most of the trade with EU countries via Kazakhstan and other Central Asian countries to Russia happens with informal economy still.
Okay, we'll get to the last part of the first half of the show here, and I'll start out with Timur. You know, Russia has been making a lot of efforts to keep its influence in Central Asia lately. I was wondering if you could speak about that.
Yeah, that's true. Since Russia has become much more isolated than ever before, I think right now Moscow found itself in a position that it really doesn't have much countries that are still welcoming Russian officials on their territory, or at least stay neutral about the war in Ukraine. And Central Asia has become this territory where Putin is still welcomed, and those countries, they do not take sides in the war in Ukraine. And that is why, Putin is doubling down on Russia's presence in Central Asia. But also, I think that, since Russia has started its war, it kind of understands that its global reputation is undergoing very serious changes. And especially in Central Asia, many people are, talking about how we should support Ukraine, etc. And in this moment, Russia understands that it should at least keep its presence in Central Asia as before. And that is why in 2022, we saw a diplomatic renaissance between Russia and all Central Asian countries. Putin, for the third time in the history of his presidency, made a trip to all five countries in 1 year. Almost all members of the Russia Security Council have visited Central Asian countries on different occasions. And, you know, new initiatives are being talked about. Well-discussed trilateral union between Russia, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan on trade of gas and also cooperation in gas industry, but also, you know, other talks of being more active in economy, talking about this promotion of Russian language, etc. These are you know, new kind of initiatives that Russia wants to push in Central Asia, and by doing that, tries to keep its positions in Central Asia as they were at least before. And we see some results of this already. In 2022, there was a growth in bilateral trade between Russia and almost all Central Asian countries. In Uzbekistan, Russia became number one investor in 2022. China was number two for the first time in several years now. It kind of like Russia forgot about its relationship with Central Asia for a long time. And now when all countries turn their back to Russia, Russia is kind of wanting to prove to everyone that it still has friends. And that is why it's kind of turning to Central Asia. And I wouldn't say that the political elites in Central Asia are not happy about that.
Okay, thank you. And Erica, I'd like to get your view on that also. I mean, Russia certainly has been making a lot of effort lately to keep it, you know, keep in Central Asia to the greatest extent possible. How do you view that? Are they succeeding?
It's really a mixed bag for Russia, because they are now seeing bigger challenges than ever before coming from society. As Timur said, that there are more and more people now openly disagreeing with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and there have been rallies in support of Ukrainians in Kazakhstan and smaller rallies in Kyrgyzstan. And the general discussion, public discussions, have been unfolding all across Central Asia, but I think especially in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, about Central Asian countries' history with Russia. So the idea that Russia was not as benevolent empire that lifted people out of poverty and, I don't know, brought modernization, electrification to Central Asia, but it was in fact a brutal colonizer that killed millions and erased cultures. That idea has now entered the mainstream in most cities, I would say, in Central Asia, but especially in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And we see various spontaneous civil society initiatives, so art initiatives that highlight the brutal history of Russian colonialism in Central Asia. So that's something that became more and more visible now in Central Asia. So Russia has to really go against this bottom-up grassroots resistance against Russian dominance in the region. And that's much harder, I think, for Russia to confront in Central Asia compared to just pushing around Central Asian leaders to align with Russia. So it's now the society, especially again in urban areas, that are resisting Russian narratives about Soviet Union, and it's about its current foreign policy. And so there is this happening, but also Central Asian societies are still quite divided. There are still quite big numbers, and it's hard to really make an estimate, but quite large groups that are firmly supportive of Putin. They are as much influenced by Russian misinformation, disinformation campaigns as Russians, Russian citizens in Russia. And those divisions run really deep in the region. And some famous, I know my family is divided along those lines. And it's really interesting to see how the idea of Russianness and the great Russian culture is becoming deeper in some circles, those who support Russia, and really is confronted and resisted and dismantled by others. I think it's disorienting for Russia. It's also disorienting for national leaders. And Kazakhstan has shown how difficult it is for the government to deal with those opposing views. But I think Kazakhstan also showed how symbolic support of the new discourse, the discourse that resists Russian colonialism and oppressive foreign policy, is also it can gain popularity, national popularity, can bring popularity to the regime as well. So those are really interesting times, I would say, but also very difficult, I can imagine, for Moscow to navigate.
Great, thank you. And this is actually the topic of our second half of our program. So I'm glad you were speaking about that, because it's going to be an easy transition now. But we have reached the halfway point in our discussion. So it is time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis podcast, Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinner, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. We're talking about the recent changes in Central Asia's partnerships with and perceptions of Russia 1 year after the Kremlin's war started. And joining me to discuss this are Timur Umarov, a fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and at the OSCE Academy in Bishkek, and Erica Murat, a professor of political science at the National Defense University in Washington. And Erica, well, let's continue with you. I mean, this is one of the things that I think is fascinating. When I was in Central Asia in the early 1990s, people in their 20s or 30s would kind of mumble about how horrible it was that Moscow hadn't treated them very correctly, and that in fact it held them back. They would be much further ahead if they hadn't been stuck under Russia's thumb for as long as they had. But that was kind of really quiet, you know. And so that, well, now those people are in their 50s or 60s. But now you mentioned colonization. This was a word that, as much as you'd hear complaints about Russia's policy toward Central Asia during Tsarist time or the Soviet Union time, no one I can think of ever said the word colonization. But now it's out there. Can you talk about how this has become some of the public discussion in some of these countries?
The discussion that Russia has been since the Tsarist regime, a colonizing, brutal colonizing power in Central Asia that, again, erased cultures and historical memory and killed millions of people, that those discussions have been percolating among activists and scholars in Central Asia for about a decade now, but they really entered the mainstream with the war of in Ukraine. And now it became this normalized idea in wider scholarly circles and activist circles. And I think more and more people who disagree with Russia's brutal war, genocidal war in Ukraine, now also see Russia as a colonizing power. They attach this definition to Russia as a colonizer, as opposed to an empire that built brotherly union, or whatever the Soviet propaganda made us believe. And the way the general public is becoming interested, I think, in the discourse, in the decolonial discourse or postcolonial, whatever you call it, discourse, is through trying to understand and internalize traumatic events from Tsarist and Soviet history, and specifically in Kazakhstan, the Sharshalik, the hunger in the early 30s, that is now widely discussed in Kazakhstan as this important part of Kazakh history that tells a lot about the resilience and the suffering and the current identity of Kazakhs in Kazakhstan, what it means, the meaning of trauma on the family level, on community and national level. And in Kyrgyzstan, the traumatic event that is widely discussed and becomes this lens through which the society now sees Russia, current Russia, and its aggression in Ukraine is the exodus of Kyrgyz in 1916, who were running away from Tsarist regime to China, and many perished along the way. So this reprocessing and trying to understand historical tragedies, it also is now linked to understanding of what Russia, what kind of Russia is as a country, how does it build its foreign policy and its relations with neighboring countries that, again, it's not a benevolent empire that gives away its wealth to neighboring countries like it wants to present itself, but in fact, it feels entitled to controlling neighboring countries and to impose Russianness and to kill people that disagree with Russia.
Thank you. Timur, you can pick up on any of those points that Erica raised if you want, but I'm also curious about, you know, I've seen calls in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan to open up the old files from, you know, the great purges of the 1930s or even going back to the 20s. And of course, in Uzbekistan, they have rehabilitated some of these people officially, including Basmachi. Do you think this is the genie out of the bottle, so to speak? We're going to see more of this where people, the local populations, are going to demand to know more about the repressions that their grandfathers and great grandfathers and grandmothers and great grandmothers suffered under Russian/Soviet rule?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the first several decades of Central Asian countries being independent, the main narrative that was going on about Russia, about the history, was in hands of people who actually grew up in Soviet Union and were, you know, brainwashed, to be honest, by the Soviet education system. And that is why all of the talks about decolonization were very marginal and sometimes called even like extremist, etc. But right now, the main narrative in the hands of the young people who are, 50% of Central Asian population who were born after Soviet Union collapsed. And these people are, those who know how to, go to internet. These people know how to use social media. And these people right now lead the main narrative about mostly everything what's going on inside Central Asia, but also about Central Asia's relations with other countries and Russia, and also about history. I've never in my life seen so many, events in Central Asian cities about decolonization. I've been to Almaty to a techno party dedicated to decolonization where, different lecturers would cite poems about decolonization written by artificial intelligence. In Tashkent, lectures about the history of Russian Empire and repressions and the fate of Jadid's movements. In Bishkek, watching movies and talking about how during Soviet times the Kyrgyz language was suppressed and the main narrative was spread in Russian. So young people are really, they do really care about how we should look at Russia, considering that, the war in Ukraine is already the third time the modern Russia starts an aggression against independent country. The first time with Georgia, it might have seemed like a coincidence, the second time with Crimea, and now the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It feels like Russia should be stopped, and everyone is afraid of what's going to happen next. And especially when we talk about Kazakhstan, which shares enormous border with Russia. So all of these happening in very naturally, and of course Russia is mad about that and tries to stop this process. But what Russia's attempts are, I think that they wouldn't be able to really change the narrative at the moment, because what Russia is doing is trying to stop the time, but it's impossible.
Great. Thank you. Erica, I'll get back to you with a question here. You mentioned earlier that there's some, you know, there's big divisions about people who are willing to support Russia and that people are not supporting Russia, and whether they don't support Russia or they actually support Ukraine. But anyway, they don't support Russia. What is the sight of so many people, so many Russian citizens fleeing through Central Asia? And, you know, I mean, it had to be more than a million Russian citizens that went through Central Asia last year. Most of them went to another country, but and some of them stayed. But to see this, you know, this is the country that, as you said, had forced its will upon the Central Asian region. And now its own citizens are fleeing right through Central Asia, where everyone can see that there's this mass exodus of people out of Russia. You know, what does that do to the perception of Russia, you think, in Central Asian region, to see that it's not, you know, it, as Timur said earlier, it's not a superpower?
Again, it's really a mixed bag here when Central Asian countries see so many Russians fleeing to Central Asia, and the roles have been inverted. Right now, it's the Russians who are looking for help and for shelter, for support in Central Asia, and not the other way around. Of course, it highlighted the main thing it highlighted is how asymmetric opportunities are for Central Asia countries and for Central Asian migrants in Russia versus Russian migrants in Central Asia. That it's much easier to be a Russian in Central Asia than a Central Asian in Russia because of racism, because of prejudice, because of just how migrants position themselves, that Russian migrants see themselves as refugees and relocated, so relocante, as opposed to seeing Central Asians as gastarbeiters or as, I don't know, illegals, right? Illegal in Russia. And the reaction to migrants has, of course, been mixed, also because of the different types of behavior that Russian migrants show in Central Asia, that some of them are openly holding pro-Putin views and have the guts to enter Kazakhstan with letters, big letters Z, on their cars, or openly complain about bad services, bad infrastructure, whatever else, bad attitude, unfriendly people in Central Asia while enjoying their stay in Central Asia, or, you know, being able to stay in Central Asia. And that creates, of course, frictions in Central Asia, lots of conversations online and offline, and just the criticism from Central Asia and against Russian migrants, saying that we're not here to serve you. There in Russia, you have almost slave-like economy where Central Asian migrants support your service economy, and therefore your services are excellent there. But here in Central Asia, the story is different. It's our homeland. You are here just like any of us. We're not here to serve you. So these are the kind of discussions that take place. But at the same time, of course, there are people who are seeing an opportunity in engaging with Russian migrants by finding new ways to collaborate, especially with people who are in tech industries, trying to find ways to build joint ventures or provide Russian migrants with opportunities to work, to find employment in Central Asia, to keep their talent in the region. And again, it's a really mixed bag. I hope that in the future, it leads to more positive outcomes and better perceptions of Central Asians in Russia, also not just of Russians in Central Asia. But yeah, it has been nothing short of surprising conversations and developments in the last year.
Great. Thank you. Okay, well, we're getting close to the end of the show, so I have my last question, although you're free with your remaining time to comment about anything else that you want to. But, you know, for 30 years, the relationship between Central Asia and Russia has pretty much gone along on the track that it's been on. There hasn't been a lot of disruption or anything like that. But that seems to have ended. You know, it is Have we reached a point where there simply must be a new relationship between Central Asia and Russia and there is no going back? That's my question. And I'll start with you, Timur.
I think that the war in Ukraine definitely has a big impact on relationship between Russia and Central Asian countries. If structurally not much has changed, the political elites in Central Asia still have a big level of trust towards the political elites in Russia and pretty skeptical to see Central Asian countries on the high level really drifting away from Russia. But the biggest change happened on the grassroots level, and I think people look at Russia right now much differently than they used to. They, on the one hand, you know, of course, divided, but the level of support of Ukraine is growing. For example, in Kazakhstan, there is an organization, Demoscope, that had several waves of surveys, and the number of people who support Ukraine in the war is growing since April. It's not much, but still. And I think what really has changed, and I do hope that from the Russian side also, those, you know, hundreds of thousands of migrants from Russia to Central Asia, they knew, you know, nothing or close to zero about Central Asia. I mean, I lived in Russia for a long time and I have many friends. And even some very well-educated people in Russia knew nothing about Central Asia and thought that Central Asia is something like Afghanistan and or Iran or, you know, something that is so not like what they used to see in their daily life. So I hope those people who, you know, came to Central Asia will look at the history of Soviet Union from the Central Asian point of view and make conclusions about how their lives changed after the war and how they were welcomed by Central Asia. And in the long-term future, it will lead to some really friendly and respectful relationship between Russia and Central Asia.
Great. Thank you. Erica?
I absolutely agree with what Timur said, that the biggest change took place on the grassroots level. And more and more people now, and it's, you know, it's a double, how can I say? It's an overlapping process of trying to reprocess own history and own identity, trying to understand the past, or it's at some point imagine the past because most records are still concealed or destroyed. Imagine the past before 1917, so before the Soviet Union and the Russian Revolution, and during Stalin's regime. So trying to find, rewrite the history, reprocess history on the one hand, and on the other hand, see Russia through a new lens of Russia being an aggressive country that has really genocidal foreign policy, and that Ukrainians are fighting for Central Asian countries as well. And in the future, I think that this is really an unstoppable process at this point, as Russia continues to decline. And I think there is really hard, it's really hard to imagine how Russia will get out of this as a strong country. As Russia continues to decline, I think more and more Central Asian countries and people will also find Russia as not as an attractive place to be, to go, or Russian culture as the main culture in Central Asia, the greatest culture in the world, as again, the Soviet Union made us believe. And at the same time, it doesn't mean that Central Asian countries will necessarily be strictly pro-Western or pro-Chinese or pro-anything else. It is really for Central Asia looking for own identity, own foreign policy, own values, again, reprocessing who we are, what we are, where do we belong, what are our values, what are our identities. And based on that, in the long term, I think foreign policy in Central Asia will also change away from Russia, maybe more inward looking within Central Asia. That's obviously a hope for many of us. But also maybe aligning more with the global South, with other countries in Asia, in Asia, in in East and West. So we'll see. But it's an interesting time. And I'm glad we're having this conversation.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you both. I mean, we covered a lot of ground in this podcast. I appreciate it. Both were, I think, two of the only people I know that could actually talk about such a wide range of issues going on in Central Asia. So thank you, Erica. And thank you, Timur. And a big thanks, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.